I was involved in the beginning of what can be considered the Right to the City movement in Berlin, meaning we, from a more academic point of view or background, started the first Right to the City conference here in Berlin and, you know, tried to introduce this as a new way of bringing together concerns and struggles that take place in the city and to find a new way of, you know, communicating across different scenes that have been out there and struggling for a long time, dating back to the squatter movement and, you know, and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, so that's where I was engaged in. And then this kind of like switch to what I think is now one of the most dominant or, well, important struggles taking place in Berlin from a radical perspective, which is focused on housing, the rising costs of housing or rents, because Berlin is a city of renters. So most of the city lives in flats that they pay, you know, rent for. And these costs have been exploding in the recent years. And that has been the subject of new forms of struggles and movement activism in Berlin for the last years. I think the struggles around rising rents, cost of housing, are the focus of most of radicalism in Berlin right now. So there has been a series of demonstrations for the last couple of years with a lot of people, which I think really re-strengthened or showed a re-strength of what has been movement activism in Berlin. Because prior to that, we had a lot of struggles. So end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s, there was a lot of like what you would consider radical activism, which was concerned about the formerly squatted houses, so all those projects, because we in Berlin still do have a very extensive alternative infrastructure, if you want to call it that way. So there's a lot of places where, you know, prefigurative politics and, you know, other forms of dealing and living, and also these are places where, you know, movements start from. So there was a lot of struggle around that because they were threatened, of course. And the struggle for rents or against rising rents has been a way of reframing some of those struggles in a way which I think is really a good way, because it started to kind of like cross or make more porous the borders of, you know, what is radical activism, which often tended to be a little bit more isolated in its own scene. So you have like demonstrations where, you know, people rally in the streets and make visible themselves. However, the gap between that sort of activism and what the rest of the urban society of the city does and suffers from has been strong or sharp, right? And the rising rent movement is a very particular, and I think, as I said, a very good way, because it all in a sudden involved and made itself open to a wider range of people. So for the last 2 years or so, a new kind of like, you know, activism emerged or got strengthened or became more visible, and they found a common voice and they came together in this rising rent struggle. So there's not only any more punks and anarchists who live in, you know, their little, I don't want to belittle them, but who live in their houses and projects, but other, you know, segments of populations who are affected by this shared problem, which is rising costs of housing and living, came together, including migrant families and elderly people and people from the formerly public housing estates, and these sorts of struggles found a common denominator. And I think it's not an accident that this happened, because Berlin is a city where a lot of people come to and a lot of people live, and it's also a poor city, right? But the struggle about jobs or, you know, employment, which is difficult in Berlin, it's not a place where you get rich easily, Because a lot of people are unemployed or live on very precarious jobs, even though they try to make it fun one way or the other, but others struggle to do that. But rising cost of housing is a shared denominator of all those people, and thus it brings together different segments of people.
In your opinion, how could people, also new in relation to the movement or the city, can take part in the political actions in Berlin? You said it might be easier now than a few years ago. Do you have more ideas how it could be made more possible to make it easy for people to join the movement?
Well, it's hard to talk about the movement, right? Because there's always various movements, and in particular in Berlin, Berlin is, if you want to call it that way, a movement city, because it always, or for long, had a wide array of different movements, from anti-fascists to anarchists, you know, to squatters and all lesbian and gay movements and all sorts of stuff, right? So Berlin is a city where people, and actually a lot of people do that, who come from other places in Germany, but also from Europe and abroad, and find actually rather easy entry points into what you can call the movements, plural, right? So, because we have all those different houses and projects and different meeting and venue points for if you are already somewhat, you know, on a mindset that you would consider yourself a radical, you find fruitful ways of, you know, integrating yourself and becoming active. But as I mentioned before, I think now it's actually even easier for people who are not maybe in this particular scene or in this, you know, lifestyle, because the issue of, you know, how to live in the city and how much do I have to pay in order to live in the city, that is becoming or has become the topic of the movements. And there is, it's really remarkable to see what kind of different people get, you know, engaged in this kind of movement. Because the movement against rising rents pretty much kind of like ranges from, you know, your radicals on the streets who are, you know, anti-systemic working and doing things of that sort, but also people who try to, you know, enter politics and who, you know, work, so to speak, as an outer parliamentary oppositional group or lobby group even, right? So there's people who entered into a dialogue with the Berlin Senate and, you know, try to find new ways of, you know, lowering rents, you know, making concrete, albeit partial, you know, successes or, you know, compromises. So there's this entire range which is now open and which kind of like still comes together, because the beautiful thing is that so far there has not been a divide, you know, between, you know, anti-systemic and more in inverted commas reformist groups, but they all, you know, keep in line or are staying together. They don't let themselves divide. So therefore I think by now we do have a wide possibility or wider possibility for people to get engaged in, you know, changing the way we live.
In Berlin there's also this nowadays, I don't know how old the group of activists is, but like 15M Berlin, I suppose lots of Spanish people are a part of that. What do you think, what can the movement in German or Berlin or German-speaking areas learn from the movements that are active and that are born in the recent years in Spain? And also, how do you see the activities that 15M Berlin has made until now in Berlin, if you are if you have followed that group?
Well, I haven't been to Spain for a long time, so, and I only know the things about Spain from third parties, so from other activists and researchers who told me about Spain. But what I think is most remarkable about Spain is that it is a manifestation of, you know, and the name Indignados expresses that, right, of this indignation that makes people that do people do feel they are enraged, they are frustrated, and you know, and angry about the failed promises that the system created for them now, and they found ways of responding to that in common, right? So that's where you have those assemblies, and they found ways of dealing with this mass unemployment, and where, you know, so many hopes and dreams so clearly shattered, right? It's just recently that I saw on a presentation by a woman who was working on the Indignados in Spain, and she had this a picture of this poster where they it was said, what was it? I never dream, or I, you, no, it was a slogan. It said, "You will never have a home on your own," right? So this entire dream that or hope that was nurtured in the last years, that you know you can become a homeowner and become you know a member of society, and you know you can live well and all that stuff, that sort of like bubble really burst in Spain more clearly than in other countries. And the beautiful thing about Spain is that they found ways of, you know, bringing those individual sufferings together and find ways of, you know, communicating that and articulating and developing a voice. And I think that is what, you know, what's inspiring of Spain for the rest of Europe, even though the situation is different, because unemployment is on a larger scale, especially in contrast to Germany.
And also the actions against forced evictions in Berlin, do they have Spanish roots?
No, I don't think so. I think it's kind of like a response that developed in Berlin as well as it developed in Spain, because it's, you know, it's the same. So it's no accident that a similar response developed.
We have been part of the Blockupy days for the 2 years Blockupy has existed, and we have came from Finland, and the way we have participated was making video reports to Finland about that, and we sometimes we faced some difficulties in filming in the demonstrations and in interviewing people, and we thought that that making videos is most urgent in order to try to make the movement Europe-wide and to let people know what is happening and so on. So we were a little bit amazed that the German activists were not totally willing to let us do our, let's say, media activism. And in Spain, we have had totally different experiences. The filming is a central way of everyday activism. So what do you think, why is it not that easy in Germany to film during concrete activism, during demonstrations?
Well, that has much to do with the way police is surveilling activism. And we have a long struggle in Germany against the way police is surveilling demonstrations. So they have started, and probably that's the same in Finland and in Spain, you know, where whenever there's a demonstration, then there's like a cohort of police, you know, walking aside, and then they have their little cameras and they film everything. So, and those films do then get used in trials afterwards. So that's why people are rather allergic against being filmed, because of the fear of that being used against them in courtrooms. I suppose that's the main reason why people are rather hesitant to be filmed, because that's evidence.
What do you think about jumping to the final questions, 12 and 13? Mm-hmm. So first, I'd ask just the most generic question, because it's always nice to hear answers for this one. So how would you describe at the moment the most central problems of our capitalistic society?
Yeah, when I read this question, I was thinking, well, hello, what kind of question? It's capitalism, stupid. But that actually, I think it's true, but I think we have to go a little bit deeper into the thing. And I only have, like, you know, my own thoughts of and loose ends, and I can't really put them together. But what I think is challenging and really problematic right now is that while we are in the most recent global crisis, you know, we still have, you know, societies, and particularly in Germany, where trust is still, you know, it's present. You know, people are kind of like in a state of denial, I think, you know, because it's tough to realize that the welfare states, in particular in Europe, that we lived in are maybe not that anymore. And then how to respond to that. And I think it's still, you know, the hope for that those expectations that we grew up with and that our parents, you know, lived all their life through, that they might be still valid, you know, and we don't want to give them up because anything else is worse. It's hopelessness, right? So that, I think, is that's the main problem of now, how to, you know, what to do with this kind of, like, you know, fearful middle class and lower classes as well, or like working classes as well, who have, you know, no real hope for anything better, and only try to at best to defend what they think is, you know, a good way out. So, and unfortunately, we do see the old games and techniques of, you know, divide and rule being operative in Europe as well. You know, we can go on from, you know, all sorts of the old game of we versus them, or us versus them, from fascism, like the rise of neo-fascist movements in all sorts of countries, and also a resurgence of classism, right, of the lower classes being somewhat, you know, it's their own fault or what have you, and we don't want to fall as low, and without realizing that you might be almost as low already. And I think that's the main challenge of now, of how to deal with, you know, a system which is deeply in crisis but doesn't respond to that as a crisis.
One more last question to our listeners. What would you say to our listeners who wonder how they could participate in the, well, let's say, in the building of a new world without, well, everything, debt, shame, repression, poverty, unequalness, all that we are suffering at the moment? If there are people with a question mark in their head, what can I do right now in order to get active in constituting better futures?
Well, I think it relates to what I said earlier. It really requires us to ask those questions of, you know, where do we live in, or what's the kind of, like, situation that we live in, and asking those questions, and how much do we still believe in those promises of, you know, the good life that are presented to us, where you still have, you know, all the advertising and all the promises of, you know, this is the way out. And these promises seem to work to some point, but we have to question them and kind of, like, try to challenge them. And I think the main question of now is trying to find new ways of articulating the good life. You know, the old question, like, what's the good life? Because in the current situation, in particular in Germany, or in Europe, you could say, in the welfare state, post-welfare state situation, we are required to find ways of good life that are not only the defense of what we knew as welfare states, because, you know, to reclaim and to defend the ways the welfare state provided some kind of like balance and some kind of equality, we have to realize, and I think most people do, that these are actually also problematic because of all their paternalism and what have you, and the nationalism that that they're built up with, right? And the real challenge is of trying to find ways of what we do think is, you know, the right way of living, and to then find ways of finding, you know, common ground on that. Trying to find common ground in terms of what are our common interests and who are we, and that you can only develop in, you know, in trying and in articulating and in practicing. And I guess that's where the theme of the commons that is discussed now in various circles is kind of like helpful, because it offers a language of, you know, trying to find ways of not only thinking of and developing claims for what should be, but actually practicing things, you know. So to bridge this gap of, you know, our images of what we would like to have to what and where we are right now. So it's kind of like this pragmatic realism, but also utopianism. So to kind of like, you know, find new mixes of that. So that, I think, is what we are all asked now. And everybody has to ask those questions for herself in the now, and then to find ways of, you know, discussing that and living that with somebody else and others. And then maybe finally we also then have to realize, I guess, you know, once we find common ground with others, like the ones we are with, to realize who's against that, right? So it's not going to be an entirely peaceful and solution or way out, and it's going to be entirely contradictory. And I think we have to find ways of, you know, developing visions and utopias of now and for now, which are capable of integrating all this messy ground of the contradictory life that we're in, without, you know, losing hope, but not getting lost in hope either.
Yeah. Oh, one more short question. If there are people from outside Germany who would like to come to Berlin, and they have this thing in thought in their mind that, goddamn, in Berlin they hate hipsters and they hate tourists, and I don't dare to go there. They just think I'm an asshole. What do you say for those? Should they come bravely and walk the streets of Neukölln proudly and meet new people, or what?
Well, of course, in Berlin as well, there has been some kind of, like, you know, discussion going on about this battle against the hipster, and I think there is good ground to argue that, you know, to devalue and to make enemies out of people because of the way they dress and the way they behave and also the way they consume, you know, is not really any kind of like solution, because we only pinpoint against each other, you know, the ways. It's kind of like lifestyle versus lifestyle, and that doesn't solve much, I think. So it diverts from the real question, which is, it's not the problem that people drink latte or that they buy, you know, or pay for high rents because they're used to even higher rents in New York or wherever, right? But the main challenge it poses actually is to address those systems that make rents rise the way they do, and, you know, that make the difference of who's capable of affording a cafe latte in this area or that area, right? So that's, I think, and if you want to come to Berlin, and if you think you look like a hipster or you are a hipster, then I guess you just like are challenged, I would say, to rethink the way you live and the way you consume, and that you can do in Berlin as well as in any other place.